Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Sej Beswick, who is the founder and managing director of SceneConnex, the innovative influencer marketing agency. Sej started her career at Red Bull before taking a role at ASOS, and then, after just an 18-minute meeting with the chairman of Captivate Group, set up SceneConnex, who have worked with the likes of Nike, eBay, and Panasonic.
I am Sej Beswick and I am the founder of SceneConnex, which is the innovative influence marketing agency based across the US and the UK.
Brilliant. And can you tell me a little bit about how you came to founding this company, working in influence marketing? What was your first sort of experience of creators?
Yeah, I've actually always kind of worked within the influencer creator space. It was called various different things then: YouTubers, bloggers, vloggers, key opinion leaders. But my first ever job, aged 18, was for Red Bull. I used to drive around in one of those big minis with the Red Bull can stuck on the back. And ultimately, I had to make sure that people had a can of Red Bull in their hand at the right time. So that would be graffiti artists, it would be musicians. And that kind of was obviously pre it being within the social space, but it was still very much the kind of starting point of influencer marketing, kind of as it is today. Worked there for 3 years, worked in tech for 2 years when I started to work with tech bloggers and lots of parenting bloggers. 5 years at ASOS, and then I always say it's a bit of a happy accident setting up the agency. But I met the chairman for about 18 minutes in Shoreditch House, which is where all good business meetings happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, we got introduced through Nike and the rest was history. 3 months later, I'd worked my notice at ASOS and had kind of set up SceneConnex.
So you met the chairman of the business and decided to found it together, or it was, this is a division within the bigger agency? How exactly does it?
Yeah, so he has a holding group of six different agencies, all within marketing realms. So he's got a pure play social agency, he's got a branding agency, a PR. And we were the latest addition. We're actually not the latest addition anymore. He's got a paid media agency too. But we were the latest within the group. So we're our own agency. We have our own P&L. We run on our own, but we have the kind of chairman of support and we have shared resources. So all of the stuff like finance, making sure everything's uploaded onto company's house, that's where we kind of get the support from the group structure.
All the joyful bits of the business, P&Ls, cash flows.
Yes, exactly. What? I get to do the bit I'm good at and they can do the grown-up stuff.
What happened in this 18 minutes? I mean, that's a short amount of time to, you know, was it a pitch? Were you pitching to them or?
No, I got introduced to him through Nike. I did a lot of work with Nike when I was at ASOS. And he had an experiential agency, or he still does have an experiential agency. Nike had worked with them for ages. And they had the challenge of, how do you quantify the success of putting shoes in a room and inviting loads of people into a room?
Yeah.
And so kind of Nike said, well, there's this like nerdy girl at ASOS who always talks about return on investment. And she's always interested in the data and what it actually means from a consumer perspective. He actually lives in a million different places, so he's rarely in the UK. And when he is in the UK, his time is poor. So I met him to kind of talk about data and give advice around his one of his other agencies. And his catchphrase, which I quote him on regularly, is put your money where your mouth is. Why don't you just set up your own agency? And he always says, I'm the most excited, overly passionate person that he's actually ever met. So yeah, the rest
is the
history.
Holding company UK based. What's the holding
company? Yes, they're
company?
All, who UK is, based.
Is the person a secret or is he?
No, it's the Captivate Group.
Okay, yeah. And so when you launched, it was UK based, but you've expanded into the US as well.
Yes, exactly.
What's that been like? And what's the US market like compared to UK in creators?
Yeah, so we've covered Europe basically since day one, and it's quite easy because of time differences and stuff to kind of multi-market through the UK. We've got specialist resource on the ground. the US is very different. One, you've obviously got the time difference. You've got all of the different states that you're working to, all of the cultural nuances, the politics that gets thrown in from a marketing perspective as well. So we wanted to make sure that we did the US and we did the US right. So we've probably been trading for about 17, 18 months in the US now. And the main reason why we went there is client demand. So our UK clients that then started doing European work, that then were going, well, why aren't you in the US? Can you come and do this too? The US, you can just burn through cash so quickly because salaries, everything just costs a lot. And so you really have to go in with the right approach and making sure that you've kind of got your business plan and what you want to deliver kind of right from the off. So we have a really good team there. I spent 3 months, I believe, at the start of this year, which was slightly delayed because of the fun C word and not being able to kind of get flights and getting travel waivers and visas and stuff sorted. So all of that is now sorted. And then I'm actually going back out to LA on Monday. So it's a bit manic and I am kind of exhausted trying to get everything together.
But do again, you find though then, that the costs are higher in terms of staff and burning through cash, but are the the budgets that you're winning from clients, are they, you know, is it on a level, are they bigger too?
They're significantly bigger because of the scale of the market.
Yeah.
But also we're not, I guess when I was launching Connects in 2016, we were going out, we had one or two case studies and it was smaller based projects. Like we are, the business has been running now for 6 years. We've got those clients. We've got the names under our belt. It's far easier to go in and to know exactly what it is that you're selling, the results that that client would deliver too. I think the biggest difference from an agency perspective is, and this might be everyone's view and opinion and experience is different, but over in the UK, our clients are incredibly loyal. So a lot of our clients we've worked with for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And, you know, we're pitching on a business in the US at the moment and they're like, yeah, you'll be one of our five influencer agencies. And I was like, right, okay, well, why five influencer agencies? Mm. Also, the brand isn't that diverse in terms of what its product offering.
Yeah.
So my argument to them was, well, the influencer list that you're working with, because it's quite specific too, surely you're going to have different agencies approaching, having different styles that represent your business, probably offering different usage rights, different rates. And they're like, yeah, probably, we just like agencies. And they're like, we'll just decide, you know, which month, which campaign we want to work with. And so the loyalty thing will be really interesting as we can kind of continue in market to see how that changes.
Because surely that doesn't give the best results because the narrative is just a bit different if you're going through five different things. I find that interesting.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. But I think there's a lot of chop and change, see what's out there and just... I think there's also an excitement of a new agency that's proposition is slightly different and the fear of missing out. So, just kind of bidding against each other to see what happens.
Yeah. I suppose with it's all the kind of fresh ideas. Where do you get most excited? Is it pitching for new business or is it more when you get someone on a retainer and, you know, are doing the work again? You say you've had clients in the UK for sort of 3-4 years.
Yeah, our client will always evolve our offering. So we're not doing the same thing that we were doing 5 years ago. On a personal level, I get a lot of joy and excitement from pitching and taking what their creative brief is or what it is that they want to achieve and they want to deliver and kind of selling that into the clients, getting their responses, being in a room, often these days it's still on Zoom, but getting that feedback and being able to tweak and to change. Like, I adore this space. I'm very excited, as I said, about this space. And I think that comes across when you're kind of on those calls and in the room. But equally,
what was the first deal you won when you launched Scene? Who was your first client?
First ever client was Nike.
That's a pretty good first
client. It's not a bad place to start, is it? And we've had Nike since day one.
Wow. And with ASOS, ASOS were sort of ahead of the curve when it came to creators. You know, they had the magazine featuring creators and worked with them from early stage. So am I right in thinking you were one of the first people within that kind of team at ASOS?
Yeah, I was the first person in the social team at ASOS. And then by the time I left, we were a team of 32.
Wow. And then your team now has grown. I see on LinkedIn that you're madly hiring.
Yeah, I think we're about 55-ish today. There's probably about 8 people working their notices at the moment. the joys of 3 month notice periods, and then we've got a couple of roles that we're still kind of working through. So also trying not to get a mass influx of new and trying to make sure that you give people the opportunity to settle, and we're getting towards 100 by the end of this year.
Pretty impressive. With your chairman, then, you say you have kind of the support from there when it comes to cash flow, but you don't have a co-founder. So how do you cope with the kind of day-to-day stresses of the business? Do you ever feel overwhelmed? Are you addicted to work?
I'm definitely addicted to work. I can't really lie about that.
Yeah.
But I genuinely love working, and I always have. I'd put in the hours irrespective of where I was or what I was doing. I take a lot of pride and a lot of joy out of what I do, which is very cheesy, but it also means I'm not at my laptop going, oh God, I have to do this, or I have to still kind of work through it. And I think the reality of being a founder is there's always something to do. You can always find things you want to change, adapt, restructuring, looking for hires, thinking about insights pieces, bits to go out to new clients with. And so I definitely haven't nailed the work-life balance. Yeah. I never have. It's interesting. I'm actually pregnant at the moment.
Congratulations. I did see a post on LinkedIn about that as well.
I know. I'm in so much trouble. The only place I've posted, my friend's like, why am I finding out about this through LinkedIn? And I was like, well, I could really relate with the founder of Propercorn hiding the pregnancy from her investors to make sure that she got all the investment that she needed. And they're like, you haven't posted it anywhere else. And I was like, yeah, I've been too busy. But this is the first time I'm actually really facing what happens when you're a founder and there is only one of you. As it happens, I'm not going to take a huge amount of time. I don't think, I might change my mind, off on maternity, but that is also the benefit of being a founder. I have the flexibility that if I want to work from home, if I want to be able to do weird and wonderful hours to make it work around, you know, mini baby and kind of what works for that schedule. Equally, I might completely be a different person and throw all my energy into being a parent. And so we'll see. But the main things I've got to work through at the moment are then what does the structure of the team look like to make sure that the continuation of the business, the growth, the success of all of our clients remains. And I'm not involved in any of our client work anymore because of the scale of the business. So that side of things, we've got a fantastic client service director. She kind of keeps that element of the business running. CFO kind of keeps his bits going.
Pre-pandemic, were you office-based, you know, 5 days a week? So actually, it's probably in some ways the remote working.
The remote working gives you so many opportunities. The pandemic was horrific, but it also did... It forced businesses, it forced people to change the way that they do things. And my schedule, I used to be like client dinners every single evening. And actually like, no, I value my own time and I value my own space. And working from home, again, gives that flexibility. It gives you just a bit more control of your life.
How did you find in the pandemic in terms of sort of workload? Was it that kind of budgets froze a little bit at the beginning, but then actually got bigger because people weren't doing as much, you know, outdoor, out of home?
Yeah, there was definitely a couple of weeks where everyone went into a bit of a knee-jerk reaction and a panic. And then exactly like you say, TVC, above the line, those budgets, the CMOs in place were like, actually, what should we be doing to engage our consumers? Where are they? They're on social. What are they looking for? Escapism, entertaining content. And actually, again, working within the social space, you can drive and add that return on investment piece to it as well. So we won a lot of work in the pandemic, but also the budgets that we were working with for our existing clients also then grew because they could see the metrics that were associated to it as well. And obviously coming out and people are thriving for that real life experience, those budgets are changing, the briefs are changing again. But it was kept you on your toes.
How do you feel that the education piece when it comes to clients and creative marketing has evolved? You know, and what type of thing are they wanting in terms of campaigns? Is it brand sentiment or is it more looking at the data and the hard sort of conversions? Or is it different for all of your clients?
I'd say it's different for every client. And the main reason for that is, you know, every single brand has a different level of awareness. They have a different level of trust with their customer base. What they want to achieve as an output and success metrics is different. So yes, we do a lot of brand uplift studies. What is the perception of that brand pre and post seeing influencer content, creator content, campaigns at scale, that piece we do, I would always, wherever possible, also attribute the sales and the return on investment, and looking at what the cost per new customer, the average basket value, what the deal size is, what's the how many customers return year on year out of the customers that you've brought through the creators. And I think that's important to not just see it on a campaign to campaign basis, but look at the longevity and the impact it has over time as well.
Mm. And since you've started the business in 2016, there was a kind of a big influx of influence marketing agencies into the space at that time. But in the last 2 years, it's just like gone crazy. What do you kind of think about influence marketing agencies in general? Do you think that the reputation of the space is good? Do you think it needs to be cleaned up? Like, where do you think some agencies are getting it wrong? What would you like to see?
Even in 2016, there were agencies doing this badly. And I think there is such a lot, there's a lot of negative association to the word influencer. That's for agencies, that is for brands doing influencer work, and that's for influencers themselves too. And I'd say definitely in the last 18 months, if I take an influencer for coffee or for lunch, I don't like the word influencer anymore. That's not what I want to be called. Mm. Or that a lot of influencers are thinking about what their side hustle is, so that they've got, again, the longevity in their business plan, where they might have their own clothing label, they might have their own how to build your social audience. A lot of influencers have created their own filters that you can then use across all of your content, so that there's the credibility and the expertise in the additional discipline that they want to be known for. I think a lot of the reasoning for that is there are a lot of people doing it badly. There are a lot of people that are like, I want to be an influencer because I want to be able to get a load of free stuff and post about anything and everything and smack some teeth whitening on one day and drink some boo tea the next.
Yeah.
I do think we've come out of the boo tea, very crass area of weight and diet pills and stuff like that being promoted across social. But equally, from a ASA perspective, things are continuing to get tighter and better. You've got the trade body making sure that there's fair pay across from an influencer perspective. But I worked in social when I started at ASOP, when I started at Three, and again, it was very much the Wild West. You were working it out, you were seeing what works, you were seeing what resonated with your customers, and exactly the same thing is happening within the influencer space.
What do you think in the, that's sort of the influencers that, you get a few that then tarnish the rest. But in terms of the agencies and ones getting it wrong, what are your views? What is influence marketing done badly, in your opinion?
I mean, how long have you got?
Your key, what takeaways?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Any agency that is not encouraging you to be compliant with the ASA guidelines shouldn't be allowed to operate. Businesses that equally are then hustling hard to negotiate the lowest rate possible from an influencer fee so that they can create the biggest margin. Again, there's not longevity in that. Then you've also got the agencies that are working with influencers, creating very lo-fi, crappy content that isn't considered, that doesn't align to the creative brief. And then they're slapping a load of media spend behind it in emerging markets to go, here you go, here's your big reach and impression figure to the CMO. Yeah. But again, it's not driving anything from the bottom line. It's not appealing to the right audience base. You then obviously have, from a diversity perspective, there are still businesses, influencer agencies out there who are like, here's a load of white, pretty, skinny women. And that, again, isn't representative of your customer base. The list can go on.
Do you think there's a lack of transparency in terms of the funnel from what comes in to a client that goes out to a creator? Do you think that, in terms of what margins people are making, that there are problems within that?
Probably. The honest answer is, do I know other people's business models, and do I know the GP margins that they're working to and the genuine rates that they've got? I don't know. We would always be very clear up front with our client in terms of the tiers and the brackets that they're paying for. If there is any negotiation, that gets put back into the pot so that they can pay for additional influencers to promote X product, X brand, whatever that might be. So the transparency piece is very, very important. And fair pay is something that we did before fair pay was the piece that you were being talked about.
And this trade body, this is the influencer marketing trade body that launched last year.
Exactly that.
No, the new one. Yeah. So there were a few before that, but this is, sort of the one that launched. Yeah. Very sort of recently. Yeah. And do you think that that has aided to communication between agencies? Do you think people are being more transparent and that, or that there needs to be more communication from agency to agency to really, like, you know, heighten the level of respect, really, and taking the industry more seriously?
There needs to be more communication, that always does. I think the benefit of, you know, businesses of the scale of like an Ogilvy signing up, it also gives the transparency from an influence perspective where they can say, are you part of this trade body? And there's an education piece for agencies, for brands, even if they don't work with agencies, to make sure that they are also supporting those creators too. Like we, God, how many years ago was this? We did a campaign, probably 2-3 years ago now. And there were three influencers and we put in our salary tiers of what each of the influencers would be paid. There was one black woman and two white women, and the black woman, the client came back to us and said, oh, you could pay her half the rate. And we're like, we won't do this campaign then. So we will either do the campaign with you and we will fair pay, or actually, thank you very much, but you don't seem like the kind of client that we want to work with. And equally, we don't want to be the agency that gets caught up in that.
Yeah.
And they agreed. And when we actually went out to the influencer and said, this is the rate that you're doing, it was actually amazing. It was one of my like highlights of running the business. She was like, can I jump on a call? So she jumped on a call with our, I don't know what his title was then, probably head of celebrity and influencer, a guy called Joe. And she was crying and she was like, are you seriously going to pay me this amount of money? And he was like, what do you mean? And so he talked through rate cards and they all had the exact same level in terms of following. They were creating the exact same amount of content. They had the same engagement bracket.
Yeah.
Engagement rate bracket. And he was like, let's just jump on a call. And this was pre-pandemic, so they actually met for a coffee. And he pulled together a rate card for her. And she then did this YouTube video. She created loads of Instagram stories around how no one had ever stopped her previously and said, no, this is what you should be earning and this is what you could be earning, because there's so much of like, well, what would you like to be paid? Okay, great, that rate will do, we'll throw that down. As it happens, we never got another brief from that client, but I take that as a success because we've done our bit to make sure. And it's tiny, right? That's one influencer.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of stuff that the team should be doing. And yes, it impacts our margin because we could have had an additional win, but the win really is making sure that we're doing it right by the influencers in the space.
And again, it leads into longevity because it won't be, I mean, I think I was reading something the other day about some software launching called Clara, where it's influencers feeding back on the agencies they've worked with and the rates, and you know, that there will be more transparency on that side as well. Which is that sort of qualitative data point. In terms of clients and the platforms that they're looking at now, have you seen a shift from YouTube to TikTok to Instagram? You know, have you had a campaign for Snapchat recently?
Everything, we have definitely gone through a 2-year cycle of everything being TikTok, 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 and a little bit more of TikTok. But I'm sure that is nothing new, and I'm sure you've heard this a million times. We're doing a lot more on Twitch, and we're also doing a lot more through live streaming, but also trying to do a lot of training and getting people ready for live streaming. It isn't for everyone. And yeah. I also think that's the education piece from a brand perspective, but also from an influencer perspective, of screen testing people to make sure that they will be able to host and run live streams for your brands, regardless of what the platform is.
Do you think that's a big part of the future than the live streaming element, live shopping?
Definitely. And it's you can see the focus from a platform perspective and kind of where they want to go, and taking the kind of traditional QVC model and putting it into 2022, 2023.
Because what Amazon did like Amazon Drop, and then it would have a page for creators where you could and then link it and they'd be doing video there. Do you think that Amazon's going to be quite a big player in the live stream shopping?
I actually haven't seen that, so I'd need to go away and have a look at it and pull it to pieces. I think Twitch is going to be the most interesting. Twitch and TikTok will be the two interesting ones to watch from a live stream and conversion basis.
So we have talked about creators building their own brands, but what about the subscription platforms such as, you know, on Twitch there's a subscription option. You have Patreon, OnlyFans is growing massively, within adult, but also outside of that as well. Mm-hmm. And what would that impact be on, you know, brand campaigns? Do you think they'll be able to rely on an income stream, so the brand campaigns they do will be more authentic?
In theory, yes. And that is the benefit of subscription-based model, is that the influencers, the creators, whatever we want to call them, they get to create the content that they truly believe in, that really is part of their content plan, their strategy, their vision for where they want to get to in the next 2 years, 3 years. And they are therefore rewarded for the content that is truly aligned to them. And, you know, when I was talking to influencers 5 years ago, and you're like, I remember an influencer, and I hope he doesn't listen to this because he'll know immediately that it's him because he's a good friend of mine. But he was like, yeah, I've just started working with this men's razor company. And I was like, you can't grow a beard. And he was like, yeah, Sedge, but you never know when the next brand deal's coming in. So you can just fudge it and you just have to fake it. And now when I talk to him, he's like, well, I would never touch that. And I'd never do that. Because again, as more brands have started to play in this space and have started to educate themselves on the benefit of working with influencers the right way, and it being, you know, the most overused word in influence marketing, authentic, actually it also gives them the opportunity to say no and to turn down work where their audience would question them and go, huh, why have you done that? Or, oh no, you don't have a beard. And that is the benefit the subscription piece will play, is that additional revenue stream, the support from the community. But also when you're a diehard fan, and you can have 3,000 followers and someone could be like, God, I really look up to that person, or that's where I go to for my advice, my knowledge, my education, whatever their USP might be. Actually, when you then feel like you're supporting them with a £1 subscription or a, you know, the 10 yeah. pence that they've got spare, they also feel like they are then part of helping that career to go from zero to 100 too. And that positive affirmation is also then something that supports the theory around subscription-based models.
Yeah. How have you found the development of creators' fees? Are you seeing, you know, budgets are increasing, but are the rates of creators in general increasing as well?
We're in quite a fun time at the moment because we've obviously got inflation rates, and influencers, creators, they also have bills to pay, electricity yeah. to turn on. And subsequently, there is definitely the same way that employers have increased their rates. We have communicated to our clients too that there's inflation rates that are happening across the board. Also, I think the biggest difference is around usage rights within the last 12 months, 18 months, probably longer, but I lose all track of time and how old I am and what I'm doing with my days. But it's also the education piece around where that content will live, how long that content will live for, how much media spend, which markets it's being pumped into, and that impacts the rate significantly as well. But equally, we're headed towards a recession. So
yeah. Oh, don't, please. No.
Sorry. Okay, move on. I've been married to my husband for too long. He's all doom and gloom.
It's just business pages everywhere. It's like doom and gloom. No, but carry on. We're heading into a recession, so...
Yeah, so it'll be interesting then when marketing spends shift. What then happens? Will they be working with less people creating better content, but actually making sure that that lives in more places, that it's truly integrated? Like, some of my biggest frustrations, and it's with some of our clients, like, we'll create this incredible piece of content with them and you're like, oh God, it's such a waste just living on a YouTube channel. Why aren't we using that, slicing it, dicing it, putting it above the line, putting it from a PR perspective, you can do X, Y, Z. And some clients still think so linear around, yeah. Well, I'm the influencer manager, this is what I do, that's the social media manager, that's what they do. And I do think the recession, it will impact budgets, but it will also get those teams talking more closely together and thinking about how you can make that content live in more places. But I do think you'll see a wave of brands doing ads that they don't believe in because they have to get paid.
I think you're so right with this linear kind of look on things. And we find that sometimes with our events, it's like events budget. It's like, so, you know, all these creators will come along, but we want the guarantees. Okay, well, you've bought this, which is your experiential. There'll be the earned media value organic. If you want a creator to say exactly what you want, then you pay that as well, and then bring them together. But it's like, oh no, this is our events budget, and then this is our influence marketing budget. It's like, if you bring it together, it's just going to be like so much better. But, you know, sometimes it's just bashing your head against a brick wall. Anyway, we will see. In terms of usage rights and the contractual side of that, does that sit, you know, the client says, these are the usage rights I want, or is it, and then you have to deal with a talent management agency? How does that process work? And what are we seeing in terms of, like, sort of usage rights for a year? How much more money does that cost?
Again, it's a really cop-out answer, but it is how long's a piece of string. It changes based on every single campaign. It depends on every single client, because, you know, one of the benefits of working with a Nike is you can say, you can be in a Nike store window and people are like, yeah, I don't care, just put me in that, because I can sell myself off that later on.
L'Oreal did that in a big way early doors with the their squad, didn't they?
Yes.
Piccadilly.
Yeah, exactly. And they're still probably some of the career highlights for those creators and those influencers. And it's exactly what we're just talking about when you think linear, but actually taking it and using it to its influencers, their content, the creators, to their full potential. So in terms of...
Sort of licensing rights.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot. Like, I think 75% of our briefs all include paid now. That paid budget totally varies based on the client. But what we try to advise our clients to do is put the content live, have an element of paid behind it, and then let's have a look. Let's see what's performing. Let's see what's over indexing versus paying for a usage right. I had one client who, I paid one guy with about 200,000 followers, £74,000 for a single Instagram post. And I was literally on the phone to the client. Almost crying.
Oh my God.
Please do. This is so funny because I actually... This is quite a while
£74,000 for...
£74,000 for one single Instagram post, because they were like, we want this usage right, this usage right, this usage right, this usage right. And I was like, you're literally coming about this in the total wrong way.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'll talk to anyone in your business. I will explain anything. And I've also got a finance director going, God, you're wasting so much time talking to these people. This is just what they want. This is the usage right that they want. Just get on and do the campaign. Yeah. And I was like, yeah.
Was that a digital first creator? Or was that sort of more of a celebrity? Yeah.
It was a musician.
Yeah.
And not a very well-known musician, in all honesty. And the brand was just adamant that this was the usage rights. And I was like, but what happens if the content doesn't perform? Or what happens if the content comes back and, you know, it doesn't resonate with your audience? And it was like, no, this is the usage rights we want. They got the content, posted the content. They then moved on to the next campaign. They never, ever used that asset anywhere else. They never put media spend behind it. And we still speak to the agents, to work with the agent. You're like, people are nuts.
Yeah.
And I think it was a bit of one of those end of year, I've got money to spend, so let's just spend the money and we'll worry about, and I won't have my budgets reduced next year. But you're like, again, you don't have the case studies and the data internally to then next year say, well, actually, I want 150K because I can deliver X. So yeah, that goes down in history as the biggest waste of money that I've seen.
I was interviewing Mel, who's going to be on the podcast as well, from Sky, and I think the biggest fee that she'd been presented with was £500,000. But again, it was a celebrity.
For one single post?
For one single post, yeah. But, yeah.
I also do wonder sometimes, though, whether... Like, again, I'm biased because I really believe in the brands that we work with, and the brands that we have... primarily a very household brands. I'm like the biggest Nike fan on the planet, so the fact we've got to work with Nike for 6 years. But I do wonder whether sometimes, and different agencies with the client list that they've got, you say, and Sky's different because Sky's Sky, but whether when you send an influencer, like, we'd love you to be part of XYZ and doing this, and they're like, I don't want to work with that brand, but if I can rip them off, I'll do it. So they're like, I'll add an extra zero onto the end, or I'll put this number in. And sometimes the brand will just go, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And then they're laughing and the brand's going, great, I got this person. And that's why anyone who works in this space should also go through intense negotiation training to know what it is that they're actually asking for.
Yeah. And we are seeing a move away from, you know, fast fashion. There's just been the Love Island announcement that it's...
we're working on that.
Oh, great. With
eBay. So yesterday was a great day. Yeah.
Do you think that's going to be a big trend over the next few years, that it is going to be much more eco-conscious, sustainability and good influence? And that, you know, we talked a little bit about the weight loss teas and teeth whitening, that they've perhaps had their day.
Fast fashion brands still exist.
Yeah.
And fast fashion brands have built their businesses off influencers and their own collections and selling their collections, wearing them. Do I think it will disappear? No. Do I think people talk a lot about wanting to be sustainable, wanting to follow sustainable influencers and then whether you get the full follow through. I'm cynical, but I'm a cynical person anyway. Yesterday, like when we received the brief, we've been under NDA for a while, obviously with the eBay Love Island piece, and you could genuinely see the pure, there was only probably four people in the team who knew, and all four of them were just like, oh my God. And when it got announced yesterday and the team could actually tell the team, the vibe and the culture in the office immediately was everyone going, God, this is incredible that we're working on this. And this is amazing that eBay, that Love Island are even considering it. And I think when you think about all the negative association that is attributed to Love Island, and there is a hell of a lot, actually that the stepping stones that they're taking to make it pre-loved fashion is incredible.
Yeah.
And it does then put pressure on the big ITVs, the Skys, even based on the TVC that they're selling, like, is it going to be a misguided ad, or actually is there something else that you could be using that space for that is, has a better impact long-term on the environment? But I just don't see that happening quickly or overnight.
Do you have verticals that you wouldn't touch, like, say, gambling or...
Yeah, anything... There's a few, but the main one is, like, anything vape, smoking. Obviously, there is a lot of restriction within that space too, but there are agencies that are in the influencer space that work with Philip Morris. And that is just stuff that we would avoid.
I think I was reading something about promotions. Hasn't fast food changed as well? I don't know if I was reading something about Australia that you're not allowed to do paid posts for fast food. I have to find that.
We have an FMCG lead in our team, and there is definitely something coming within that space. I haven't been in those conversations or done my research there, but yeah, there's definitely some movement coming.
And then in terms of, we've talked about platforms, and that the last 2 years has been TikTok. Have you seen a rise in what sort of verticals of creators people want to work with? Is it still like a beauty fashion main focus for you, or do you do lots of parenting campaigns? You know, you'll be a parent yourself soon. Is that something you want to...
We have quite a few parenting clients, parenting brands as clients, which is amazing. So I'm like, Tommy Tippy, what do I need? Our teams are kind of in their specialists of FMCG, fashion, tech, gaming, sportswear. So then parenting is a big one for us too. So the people we work with are then reflective of those verticals that we work in. I think there's definitely much more around education versus... Yes. So I've seen, irrespective of what tier they're in, how do you educate, support, and create more of a narrative around what it is that you're selling versus the kind of flash in the pan, here's a post, off you go.
Yeah. In terms of revenue generators, would you say that your business brings in more through like fashion and beauty than gaming, or how's it looking? Because gaming's a huge one.
Yeah, it depends, again, on what the brief is and whether it is around the awareness, the brand uplift. Fashion is easy. It's the fashion, beauty, any brand can do it with their eyes shut. And if you're not seeing a return on investment from an influencer perspective, you're doing something horrendously wrong.
Yeah.
Because it is very much see it, buy it. That journey is so streamlined. Some of the items that we work with are very expensive, high ticket items. So there's a camera that's $7,500. But you don't see one Instagram story and then go, oh, I'm just going to go and spend £7,500 or one TikTok. So it's how do you think about the different touch points, and how do you keep the education piece around the benefits of working with that camera and what it can do and the content that it can produce? So you're looking again at the over time impact that it has versus that immediate content they're driving. And someone did, like, they had, I think it was one Instagram story, and he sold three cameras at $7,500.
Wow.
But it's, you've definitely, in that instance, you can't measure the last 30 days. You do have to measure the impact over time.
And then what about affiliate marketing and links and things like that? What are your views?
Everyone still does it. I think it's great because, again, if you think about the subscription-based models that we were talking about earlier, it gives the influencers the opportunity to produce and wear and create and travel to the destinations they genuinely want to travel to, wearing what they want to wear, promoting the brands that they truly believe in. a good influencer should then also be going into that affiliate platform and really looking at what is driving the sales for their audience, so that they can then start to adapt their strategy based on who is following them. Mm. So, you know, if you're wearing an ASOS, sorry to come back to fashion, but obviously worked there forever and a day.
Yeah.
But if you're wearing an ASOS and that is driving the highest click through and the highest conversion, you're incentivized to continue to purchase from there and to continue to create that content. Whereas if you're then throwing in a $3,500 leather jacket, obviously, and actually, you know, a Hannah Stratford Taylor is a very high end premium goods. She probably doesn't sell as many units, but she definitely can look at the brands that her audience are paying from. And I think the influencer job, the agent job, is to also look at all of that affiliate insight and data, but also educate the brands when they come to them around what will work best and what will drive the highest performance for them too.
And then to wrap it up, if you are looking forward and you could win one client, a new client in the next 18 months, who is your dream client?
That is a great question. This is only because this comes second to Nike, but I am obsessed with Dyson. I use the Dyson Airwrap. I have never hoovered in my life until I got a Dyson. And I just think from a product and a technology perspective and the way that they currently market, the brand's just absolutely fantastic.
I think that's a good one. I need to get myself a Dyson Airwrap.
I should be on affiliates for Dyson Airwraps because I got mine for my birthday nearly 2 years ago. And I basically haven't ever... And one, I used to go and get a blow dry twice a week, so I've saved myself £60 a week. I then can just do it myself and it'll last 3-4 days. I tell everyone, go and get yourself a Dyson Airwrap. It's the greatest thing on earth.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogospheremagazine.com.